the icing layer was generally only about 3,000 feet thick. So you could generally find some area where you could climb up through it, but occasionally we couldn't. We'd get just about to the top and have so much ice that the airplane would start shaking a little bit, even with max power, so we'd have to descend back down and melt it off.
G'day and welcome everyone to episode number 13 of On The Step with That Mallard Guy. I'm your host, Dan Bolton. Number 13, hey? Unlucky for some, but not for you guys, as another seaplane episode is out, ready for your ears. Now, it's once again great to be back with you all to get our feet wet and talk all things seaplanes. For those of you who are new to the show, welcome. You can contact me or even just say hi if you like by email on thatmallardguy@hotmail.com or on my Instagram at thatmallardguy. Send me a direct message and I try and get in contact with everyone and reply to you all, so feel free to come on and say hello. Now, before we jump into the show today, folks, I got asked an absolute ripper of a question this week. It's a technical question, so I thought about starting up a new segment called the Seaplane School. So folks, this week's Seaplane School question, the first one out, comes from a good mate of mine through Instagram at Ryan B. Potter, who loves to dive deep into the technical side of everything. And he asks, when on the step, having an aft or forward center of gravity within the envelope makes you accelerate faster? What an absolute corker of a question. And I must admit, off the bat, I had to have a good hard think back to some of the seaplane theory from my initial endorsement over 10 years ago, and also when I did my instructor rating a couple of years back, to find some sort of answer. Unfortunately, there was nothing that shot out at me in the memory bank, so I did some digging, and this is what I found. In Dale DeRemer's famous book, Water Flying Concept, there's actually a chapter specifically on center of gravity effects, and the answer lies within basic aerodynamics. Now, if you think about the age-old diagram of an aeroplane side-on showing thrust, drag, weight, and lift, well, aircraft are designed so that the C of G is actually forward of the center of lift in order to make the aircraft pitch stable. Now, this causes a nose-down tendency, which requires the horizontal tail to produce a tail-down force to keep the attitude level. Now, this force is added to the actual real weight of the aircraft to arrive at a figure, what's called the effective weight of the aircraft, which is the weight the wings actually must lift off. Now, if the pilot loads an aircraft so that the C of G is forward, at the forward limit there, this increases the distance between the center of gravity and the center of lift. Now, that causes more nose-down tendency, requiring the tail-down force to be greater to keep that nose up, making the aircraft effective weight actually even heavier. Now, there are known aircraft performance effects of this. However, there was limited seaplane takeoff performance information available. So in 1987, a research aircraft Cessna 185 was used as an experiment to figure this out. Now, the test data that resulted from the numerous water takeoffs with both forward and aft center of gravity positions showed that on the test aircraft, there was no real effect on acceleration until about 45 miles per hour. Now, at that stage, there seemed to be more rapid acceleration of the aft center of gravity loaded aircraft as aerodynamic effects increased at that higher speed. So basically, the lower effective weight caused by that rearward center of gravity caused higher acceleration and a shorter takeoff distance. Now, that's great for aircraft that aren't power limited and have no trouble getting onto the step, but for aircraft that struggle getting to the step there, having a forward center of gravity may actually help out more in this regard. So it's a bit of a catch-22, I guess. But thanks to Ryan for a great technical question. I had a lot of fun looking that one up and finding hopefully a good answer there for you all. And I hope that got the cogs ticking in everyone's brain as well. I hope you all like this new segment, Seaplane School. Every now and again, I'll throw in a quick Seaplane School question to keep our minds fresh, especially mine, and our seaplane knowledge up to date. Okay, folks, so now it's on to today's guest. Kurt Miller is a retired Canadian pilot who has had an amazing career in aviation lasting over 50 years. He flew all types of seaplanes along the west coast of Canada, including the Mallard J26, which is now flying with us here at Paspalie Aviation in Australia. Let's throw on our winter jacket, scrape off the frost from the aircraft's windshield, and keeping warm from our morning coffee, we'll get going on the step in snowy British Columbia, Canada.
Right engine is turning. 12% fuel. A lot.
Okay, all the way from Nanaimo in British Columbia, Vancouver Island. Welcome, Kurt Miller, to On the Step, mate. How are you going?
Oh, hi, Daniel. Nice chatting to you.
Very good, mate. We're excited to have you on board, mate. Retired Mallard pilot, big, huge flying seaplane career. I'm very excited to hear all about your stories, mate. Why don't we just start off with what got you into flying seaplanes at the start of your career there?
Well, I guess what really got me into flying seaplanes, Canada, and when I started in the late 60s taking flying lessons, seaplanes was a large part of Canada, having a lot of isolated areas that were really accessible. There was no airstrips in those days. So seaplane flying was a big way to start and a good stepping stone to other aircraft.
It certainly is. I think Canada is probably one of the most famous spots for seaplane flying, isn't it, really?
Well, it is, really. It used to be noted for some of the biggest seaplane bases in the world.
Absolutely. And, mate, did you grow up in Vancouver Island there, or did you grow up more in the central Canada?
No, I grew up actually, you wouldn't call it central Canada, but I grew up in Alberta, southeastern Alberta. I grew up on a cattle ranch. And I used to be fixing barbed wire fence with my father and look at the contrails of jets going over. And I would say to my dad, one of these days I'm going to fly one of those. And I guess that's a simple way of how it started.
And when did you get into flying back in the day?
Well, I was 19 and didn't really know what I wanted to do. And I was working at a pulp mill and a friend of mine had just got a private license and said, hey, mate, you should get your license. I think it'd be fun. And even though I always liked airplanes, I never seriously thought about it. And then I got my license, I was lucky that my first flying job was in Tofino on the west coast of Vancouver Island, where somebody took a chance on me with had very little time, commercial license, but very little float time, and took me in hand and I gave me my first job flying a Canadian-built aircraft called a Found on floats, FBA-2C, built by Found Brothers of Canada, similar to a 185, a Cessna 185.
Okay, cool. So what year was this? What are we talking what year was that first job?
Well, my first full-time flying job was in 1969 in Tofino on Vancouver Island. And I'll just carry on a little bit from that, and then we moved to Tassis, which is also on Vancouver Island. No road in there in those days. We had six airplanes, a couple of Beavers, Cessnas. I was a manager there. And then 5 years in Campbell River, which had about 25 seaplanes in those days. And when I had 8,000 hours flying time, a company called West Coast Air offered me a job to fly the Mallard because of my coastal seaplane time, and I had also had an air transport rating.
Yeah, right. I saw just recently on a Facebook group that we're both mutual friends in, or mutual contacts in, that you made a comment about the required hours to get a job flying a Mallard over in the west coast there. Now, I imagine that, you know, like you said before, you got given a chance as a young guy flying a seaplane off the west coast there, but the hours to get into the Mallard were extremely high, weren't they?
Yes, they were. The company required a minimum of 5,000 hours seaplane time. 3,000 of that time had to be on the BC, British Columbia coast, and you had to have an air transport rating because that was considered a large airplane.
Yeah, that's crazy. A bit different to the some of the hour requirements these days when the pilots, you know, hiring was booming. Unfortunately, obviously, with COVID at the moment, things are a little bit on the downturn, but definitely different times. You don't really see hour requirements like that anymore unless you're kind of applying for a large airline job.
Well, that's exactly right, Daniel. And even the company I retired from, Air Canada Jazz, a regional airline, we had first officers in the right seat that had been there for 18 years.
Yeah, wow.
Well, now, just before COVID, the guys were going from the right seat to the left seat in as little as 1 year. So huge change.
Yeah, absolutely. So, mate, tell us a little bit about some of the flying that you do on the west coast of Canada. Let's set the scene a little bit about what it's like to fly along the west coast.
Well, you know, the west coast, it's beautiful. A lot of it is remote, a lot of fjords. It's changed a lot in the last 50 years, but it can be challenging weather. It can be beautiful but deadly, and it can be challenging. Lots of IFR work on the Mallard. We had on the Turbo Mallard, we had hot props and boots, so we did a lot of IFR, but it was a mixture of IFR and VFR. So we fly IFR generally to about 50 miles from destination and then do a letdown and continue the last part of it VFR, perhaps 100 feet above the water. The wintertime could see some very strong outflow winds, what we call outflow. So you could get 60 knot winds blowing out of these fjords, 60 knot winds and snowing. And just a little trivia for you, our coldest allowable temperature for operation in the salt water was minus 15. Down to minus 15 degrees centigrade, the salt water wouldn't stick to the airplane. But anything colder than that, it would start sticking to the airplane. So that didn't happen very often. That was quite rare, but you might get one or two or three day periods in the wintertime where it would go to that temperature.
What about icing? Tell us a little bit about icing on the Mallard, because I know that the Mallard is one aircraft that certainly does not take icing very well. How did you guys handle it over there?
Well, you know, it came with experience, and the airplane handled it well in some ways. Like I think I said before, we had boots and hot props, and there was occasionally, though, where we'd be climbing up trying to get above the icing. The icing layer was generally only about 3,000 feet thick, so if you could generally find some area where you could climb up through it, but occasionally we couldn't. We'd get just about to the top and have so much ice that the airplane would start shaking a little bit, even with max power, so we'd have to descend back down and melt it off. But all in all, you know, it really didn't happen that often. And sometimes on the heavy ice days, we'd fly at 100 or 200 feet for an hour and a half or 2 hours. And you almost never got icing right above the water.
I guess it's a lucky little escape there, isn't it, to be able to, just to fly at 100 feet over water and still feel safe and not get any icing and get the job done still.
Well, that's right. And departure, too, was a little when we get at our destination on departure in the wintertime, the days were rather short, so you would have a sunset about 4 p.m. in the afternoon. So as long as we were off the water by 4 p.m., we would immediately climb up to an IFR altitude and proceed IFR and arrive back in Vancouver well after dark. So we did a lot of nighttime flying as well.
Yeah, right. Well, we obviously do that as well here. Obviously, you can do that in IFR world and even in the seaplane world, just as long as, like you said, you're not on the water at the time of doing it. And we regularly kind of plan night departures in the morning, early hours of the morning, to arrive at a water location right on first light, which is pretty cool. Now, mate, you and I have something a little bit in common that even though I've never met you before, and that is that we've both flown J26, and you've probably flown J22 and 23, I imagine, which are the three Mallards that we have at Paspaley.
Well, it could be. I know that when West Coast Air or became RBC, sold their last two Mallards, two of them went to Air Whitsunday, and I'm not sure about the third one. I would have to look that one up. I thought the rest of our Mallards actually went to Miami, and from there on to different parts of the world. So you could have the third one as well.
I'm pretty sure that all three of them came there. But so obviously I spoke to Kevin Bowe in one of my episodes previously about him from Airwit Sunday coming over and getting those mallards. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened on your end there? Because were you involved at all with the ferry flight over to Airwit, or did you meet those pilots at all?
No, I didn't. One of my co-workers did that. Trained the Airwit Sunday guys. They spent a fair bit of time in Vancouver, British Columbia, to be trained on the mallard, because the two guys they sent over had never flown that type or even any other very sophisticated twin-engine aircraft. So there's quite a bit of training involved. And then I do know the crew. They took the one turbo mallard and piston mallard to Australia, but they had gone to Long Beach, California, which was the closest point of land to Hawaii, and they sat there for about a month waiting for proper winds so that they could make that trip from California to Hawaii. And they had huge bladder tanks to get them across there. But I understand that the trip itself was really quite uneventful. Everything went well.
And what other experiences did you have in the J-26, which I believe was nicknamed the Hummer over in Vancouver there?
That's right. Its registration was Charlie Foxtrot, H-U-M. So everybody called it the Hummer because it's a turbine, of course. we loved the airplane. The passengers loved it. And you know, we had very few problems. And we had the company gave us 85 hours of line indoctrination when we started flying the aircraft. So in about 15 years of operating six mallards, they never had an incident, never had an accident. So the training we had was very good. The company maintained the airplanes very well. And the only time that I felt it bite, that I got bitten a little bit, it was inexperience. We had a very large load, and most of the passengers were big fellows, over 200 pounds. And so they all sat on the back of the airplane, and some lightweights were in the front. And as you know, the nose baggage compartment doesn't have a large volume, so it's hard to get the weight up there. So the CFG was loaded quite far aft. And it scared me a bit, because the airplane really didn't fly very well with the CFG so far aft. And so I learned a little lesson from that and never did that again. But other than that, I absolutely love the airplane. Never let me down. It was great. It's my fondest memory of my flying career. And I flew for 50 years, so I love that airplane.
Yeah, it's a beautiful airplane. It still looks so great today, these days as well. It's a real pleasure to fly the Mallard and have that in your logbook, that's for sure. Did you have any issues with porpoising at all? I know that they're pretty renowned for a porpoising machine, especially coming from the float plane world to a boat.
Well, initially on the training, it took a little bit to get used to it, but I found that by the time my line of dock was done after that, I never had an issue with it. As you know, flying at Daniel, there is a technique to it, and if you do it right, no, never had any big problems that way. The other thing we used to do at a place called Ocean Falls, there was a pulp mill there. Well, in the wintertime, you couldn't take off into the valley. You had to start off. As soon as you went down the ramp, there was a cement ramp around. We'd go down the ramp, raise the gear as quickly as possible, and start off in a quartering into wind and end up turning downwind with 30 knot tailwinds. So we would take off with 30 knots on the tail, time and time again. And there again, it was, we were going pretty quick before we got airborne, but there again, the airplane never let us down.
And was that just because of terrain, was it, that you had to go downwind?
Well, that's right. You couldn't take off into wind because the end of the valley came too quick. It was too high, and you couldn't take off into wind and make the turn at a low altitude. So the only other way was to go downwind or taxi for miles and miles, which was too far. And that, you know, that had been done historically by mallard operators in that neck of the woods for probably 30 years. And so it was amazing what that airplane could do even downwind.
What kind of ocean areas were you landing in? Was it all open ocean? Was it rivers or lakes? Or
it was all saltwater. All saltwater fjords. We'd do the odd lake charter, but our scheduled work was was all saltwater. Most of our operations were either land and taxi up a cement ramp to load and offload, but quite often go to docks where we'd nose in, put a rope on the nose ballard, shut down the port engine, and with a lot of help from dock workers to get us in. So it was a mixed bag. We did quite a few charters too, tourists, fishermen. So yeah, it was busy times, but the BC, British Columbia coast was different in those days. A lot of remote big logging camps, fishing resorts, and that has kind of fallen by the wayside a bit.
Yeah, right. I know that there's an operator on Vancouver Island up the north there at Port Hardy, Wilderness Seaplanes, who still run the Goose up and down the coast there. Are you aware of those operators?
Yes, I am. I'm aware of the Geese. I think they have about six of them. They're still operating there. And Port Hardy, too, used to be quite a busy place. In the old days of piston airplanes, it was kind of a stepping off point for Alaska, last fuel stop. But the seaplane thing on the West Coast has really, really changed. Not as many seaplanes, but they do more tourist work these days than we used to do, the workers. So that part has changed quite a bit.
Okay, yeah, I mean, you're right near Harbour, I believe, just across the ocean there. And, when I Googled where you lived, a picture of a seaplane, a beaver sitting on a dock came up as the main picture of your town. So obviously... seaplanes rule the world over there at that in that part of the world. It's a beautiful spot. So went back to the Mallard kind of stuff there. Did you start off as a first officer, or did that kind of experience put you straight in the left seat?
No, I was one of the few people that experience put me straight in the left seat, and there again was because of my rather large seaplane experience and the fact that I had an air transport rating. I was able to go straight into the left seat. And in those days, I got an air transport rating just by getting the book, sitting under a tree, and basically doing it by correspondence, all of the exams.
Did you train up a lot of first officers in that role?
Yes, I did. And I wasn't in the training department on the Mallard, but after the Mallard, I was in the training department most of my career.
And what other seaplanes did you fly for Air BC and West Coast Air?
Oh, let's see, Cessnas 172, 180, 185, 206, Fairchild Husky, FE-11 Husky, de Havilland Beaver, single otter, twin otter, and a few little airplanes too on floats like a Tri-Pacer and a Luscombe.
Experience in all different types of seaplanes.
Yeah, that's right.
Does one of them stand out as a big highlight in your career, other than the Mallard, I imagine?
Well, yeah, the Mallard, of course, is the number one. I guess the other airplane that gives me a warm and fuzzy feeling is the de Havilland Beaver. It's a marvelous airplane. It's slow. It's, it does a marvelous job. It's very reliable. Pilots love it. The customers love it. It's a great airplane.
Absolutely. Have you got any good stories about flying the Beaver on the West Coast there?
Well... I don't know if I have a good story flying the Beaver. I have a good story flying a Found.
Go for it.
The Found airplane, the fuel gauges never worked, so we used a dipstick to dip the fuel tanks, and we didn't carry too much fuel because, as you know, fuel is weight. So early in my career, my boss said, I have a trip for you. Go pick up these four fellows. I dip the tanks. You have enough fuel. So I picked up these four fellows, loggers, and they had been drinking a little bit too much. And they were giving me a hard time. They knew I was new. And so I flew a little bit off course before I realized I was off course. And then I headed back to my destination. I knew I was getting low on fuel. So I kept it high, and I ran out of gas. But on descent, as you know, the propeller keeps going around. And they didn't know that the engine had quit. So I dead-sticked it onto this river, and as we fell off the step, I guess there's a little bit of fuel in there. The engine started running again. I taxied up to the dock, let these fellows off, and I thought, oh boy, I'm in trouble. They're going to complain. Well, later on, the dispatcher said to me, what did you do to those guys? And I said, oh, what did they say? And she said, oh, they're always such a pain in the butt, but they said it was the best trip they ever had. So... I learned a lesson from that, a big lesson from that as well.
Yeah, right. Always give those guys another stop off. That's what the lesson was, I believe.
That's right.
I remember, I mean, we used to fly Beaver in the Whitsundays, and you'd have the belly tanks, you know, the forward and the mid belly tank there. And I believe maybe just forward and rear, you'd run one of them you couldn't dip because the angle where the filler neck was had a 90 degree bend in it to go to the forward tank.
Right.
So you'd normally top that up with, say, or you'd fill the rear one up because you could dip that. You'd just fill up to 130. And then the other one, you'd just put the extra fuel you needed in it. But there always came the problem that you could never use all of that fuel in that tank unless you basically burnt it until the engine kind of, well, the
That's
fuel pressure
right.
gauge started flicking, you know what I mean? And I remember one day, you know, we're coming into the airport. I was actually in the right-hand seat training with a guy, and we basically had this technique where you'd once you got down pretty low in that tank, you'd keep your two fingers on the gauge and the fuel pressure gauge as well, so the fuel gauge.
Yes.
And just to keep reminding you to look down and look at that the fuel pressure to see when it started to flicker, you know, because as soon as it started flickering, you just turned the tank over, no one had noticed. And obviously joining the circuit, there must have been a bit of traffic there. And all of a sudden, the 985 of the Beaver just goes silent for a second and straight onto the wobble pump to build up a bit of pressure, turn the fuel selector to the next tank, and away she went. And I don't think anyone even knew in the back. Like you said, the prop was still turning. The tricks of the trade, obviously.
That's right. And I think anybody that has much time on a Beaver, and as you started telling that, it reminded me, too, a similar situation. I had six passengers on board the Beaver. And anyway, I was usually pretty good about that, but I was on a long trip. It was a couple-hour trip, and I had to go to the bathroom. And so, you know, I used a little sick bag to do my business. Luckily, I just had fellows on board. And just about halfway through my business, a low-pressure fuel light came on. So my hands were flying pretty quick without making a mess of things to get that engine to keep running. That was a little embarrassing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a crazy seaplane life, isn't it, sometimes? The flights and some of the stuff I've got to do.
Daniel, how much time do you have?
Mate, I'm about just after 4,500 hours around that area. Obviously, with float planes, we don't do it for the hours in the logbook, do we? You know, like I think the most flying I think I've done in a year is probably only up near 500-600 hours, depending on the job we're doing. So
I know I was going to ask you that, and we used to fly 1,200 hours a year on the Mallard.
Yeah, wow. No, nothing like that here. I mean, we're doing about 400 hours, I think, at the moment.
Okay. So what do you do with all your time off?
Mate, talk to cool seaplane pilots like yourself. That's what I try and fill my time in. This podcast has mainly come about because of the COVID stuff, and you know, we've reduced this time of the year flying the Mallard. We pick up a lot because of it's the dry season in the north of Australia, so there's a lot more tourism and charter work. But with the COVID, there's not much happening at the moment, so trying to fill in a little bit of extra time. But
right. So what are your ambient temperatures usually like this time of the year?
So where I live in Darwin, we're pretty hot all the year round. So I think in the summer, which is the wet season here, we kind of sit around the 34, 35 degree mark with about 100% humidity nearly all the time. And minimum temperatures, you know, 26, 27 degrees at night, Celsius. And then in the dry season now, we're still around the 30 degrees every day, but the kind of overnight temperatures drop down to about 19. So it's hot, and then it's wet and hot, basically.
Right. Do you have with the warm temperatures and salt water? Do you have any serious corrosion problems?
Yeah, I mean, like any other seaplane, we do have corrosion issues, but because we don't fly the Mallards as much as, say, like you guys do, and most of our legs are kind of 1.5 to 2 hours one way, and then a quick water landing and then back, and that's kind of all the water work we do. They kind of don't seem to show the signs of corrosion that, say, seaplanes that operate in the water all day long and then at the end of the day get a wash finally. So they're well looked after. I mean, our main operation is purling, so the purling company, you know, requires them, so they do invest the money. You know, it's not like a we're pretty lucky that the fact that it's not like a charter company where, you know, maybe sometimes they have to kind of push the boundaries a little bit more to make ends meet, whereas we're kind of like this is more like the company ute this aircraft for the purling operation rather than the moneymaker, if you know what
okay.
I mean.
Okay. So now, did you say you have three mallards?
We do, yeah. So we've got J-22, 23, and 26.
Now, are they all turbine conversions? Or
they are, yeah. So when Paspaley bought the three mallards, we had one turbine, which was the G-Hummer, and we had two pistons, and they found that the turbine mallard was way more reliable. They had issues
yes.
with the pistons,
yes.
and they converted them. They wanted to convert them to the Frakes turbine conversion, but there was a few issues there. So basically, they just designed them themselves. And
Perth, oh, did they?
Yeah.
So if you got the Dash 34s in them, or?
Yeah, Dash, that same engine, but we have. So our mallards are three unique mallards. They're designated a G73AT, which stands for Australian Turbine Mallard. And
okay.
So they're actually different to the Frakes version. There's not much differences, but cowlings and a few extra handholds, doors.
Okay.
So yeah, it's
are there anything on the wings?
We have droop tip ailerons. We've got vortex generators on the top there, stall strips. So yeah, they did a bit of modification of the wings. I mean, our flaps only go to 20 degrees rather than the 40. I think the original mallard
right.
went to.
Yes, okay.
Our engine cowlings are a lot different. They've got, if you look at a picture of ours, the trailing edge of the cowling there goes all the way past the flap, which doesn't do that on the Frakes version. They found in some flight testing that the airflow over the top of the fuselage there in between the two engine cowls, during approaching the stall there, the airflow was actually going forwards.
Oh, really?
Yeah, on the Frakes version. So they actually did a bit more testing with those cowls and found that these extended cowls, they improve the airflow over the whole airplane. So
right. They probably kept the leading edge slots, though, did they?
Yeah, the slots are still there, yep.
Yeah, yes. So. Yeah.
How did you find the piston mallard versus the turbine when you were flying them both over
there was a huge difference. I mean, they both flew well, but, you know, the turbo mallard had a, I believe it was a 14,000-foot service ceiling, single engine. And we had the highest peak, and our route was right around 13,000 feet.
Wow.
So IFR, of course, would have to go above that. The piston mallard, you wouldn't be up that high. And it was, you know, with a lot slower and a lot of work. You really have to look over after that engine, and, of course, you had magnetos and carb heat and mixture and
cowl flaps
right, and quite complex to actually start that airplane, the piston mallard. Did you fly the piston?
No, I never have. No.
Yeah, it was the turbo mallard was the first turbine aircraft I ever flew, and I always had this vision that it would be a complex thing to operate and run, and I was so surprised at how simple it was compared to a piston.
Yeah.
As you know, starting a turbine is just so very easy.
Starting
that piston engine was quite complex. And if you didn't do it right, you kind of mess it up.
Exactly, yeah. It's so funny in aviation. I feel that the hardest jobs sometimes are the ones that we start off in. You know what I mean?
I've often said that the difference between piston and turbine, especially the bigger engines, turbine is so simple. But one other little thing I was going to say to you, the Mallard was probably one of the most stable airplanes I ever flew.
Yeah, I've
you
heard
know,
that a bit from people.
Yeah, you can, especially it had no autopilot. And, you could trim it up and take your hands off of it and look away as long as you didn't touch anything. It would still be going where you left it. And, the twin otter and floats, for example, I wasn't fond of it. It was kind of like driving a truck with loose steering. It was all over the place, but different, totally different type of aircraft.
Talk to us a little bit about what the twin otter stuff that you did. Was that after the Mallard and the ABC stuff?
Yeah, when I was flying the Mallard, the company I worked for, West Coast Air, they had twin otters and float twin otters, but they wouldn't mix. If you were a mallard pilot, you were a mallard pilot, and they wouldn't put you on the twin otter and floats because they are so different. Landing attitude, just what you do with the airplane, is so different. And I wasn't a fan of the twin otter. You know, the twin otter did a good job on very short haul, rough water, like Vancouver to Victoria, Vancouver to Nanaimo, short, you know, 20-minute, 30-minute flights. But they were very slow. And so if you had a trip of any distance, you're always making fuel stops. I shouldn't really badmouth the aircraft because it did a good job, the twin otter and floats, for a very short haul, rough water work. But
well, that's it. And you see where it is, you know, most popular. That is the Maldives, and
yes,
that's basically it. You know, like less than an hour long sectors. I'm sure they got a few that are longer than that, but generally island hopping with heavy loads and rough water, that they're perfect for the job. But I mean, the twin otter for us example, it's not the airplane that will replace the Mallard at all, because we require the extra speed in the air. I mean, we're doing, you know, we're tazzing at 180. We've got great payload, taking, you know, 1.2 tons of payload with 3.5 hours endurance. So, we're getting to the longer, you know, the most isolated places in Australia quickly with big payloads. So the twin otter will never do that job.
Right. Now, do you have...
Especially an amphib.
Yeah, you have twin otters and floats, do you?
No, we don't, no.
Oh, you don't? You don't, oh, okay.
But yeah, because, I mean, because the Mallards now are getting a bit long in the tooth, I guess, the company's always looking at potentially what will be the next thing to replace them. You know, we've had them for nearly 30 years. They're 70-year-old airplanes.
That's right.
And even though the twin otter's being made brand new again, they just can't do what the Mallard does.
Yeah. So for anyone I've ever known that has flown a twin otter on floats and not a Mallard, they like the twin otter. But if you've flown a turbo mallard first and then they send you to fly a twin otter and floats, you'd be quite disappointed.
Apologies to all those twin otters drivers out there that are listening.
well, that's right.
That's Michael Steers said that as well. He was a Virgin Islands seaplane shuttle pilot. He found that the same thing. You said the twin otter was great for what it did, but you know, the Mallard will still always be in his heart, I think.
Oh, that's right. And there's something about a boat versus a float plane. The boat, you know what it's like, and it kisses the water. And there's just, I don't know, it's almost romantic.
Exactly. Yeah, it is. And did you get to fly any other boats at all?
No, that was the only boat I ever flew. Yeah, I one other boat I thought would have been interesting to fly was the Canadair CL 215.
Absolutely, yeah.
The 415. I thought they would be interesting. Of course, that was only firefighting work. But how about yourself, Daniel? Are you, what's your plans? Are you going to stay with the seaplanes?
Oh, I think so, yeah, man. That's why I got really into flying, and it's what I love most about flying, I think, is the versatility and the unique aspect of seaplane aviation. So I'll be around here for a long time. You know, we're quite stable in this job and we love where we live. And so, we'll be around here for a lot longer.
Good.
It's always a bit difficult in Australia as well about, you know, what that next move is up the chain. I think what we're doing right now is basically the best seaplane job in Australia, potentially, you know, if not the world, getting to still fly one of the great flying boats. But, keep enjoying it. I mean... aviation careers, like you said, they can be so long. Like you said, 50 years, it's a lot of time to change around, and I don't want to waste these years doing some of the best flying that I'll probably ever do, you know.
Well, that's right. And you know, when we were flying the Mallards here in British Columbia, I know that we were thought of as having the best seaplane jobs in Canada, and we're also the highest paid. The money was good. You know, flying a seaplane, the company was good, the equipment was good. They had people lining up at the door trying to get that job. And how did you start, Daniel?
With float flying in general, or just
yeah, with Mallard? Flying in general. In general, did you grow up wanting to be a pilot? Or?
Yes and no. My old man ran a seaplane business back in my hometown of Geelong. He had a 206 floats.
He?
Yeah. But that wasn't that wasn't until I was about 15, 16. Aviation's kind of in my blood. My grandfather was a Spitfire pilot in World War II in New Guinea. Mm. Also Tiger Moth instructor. And my uncle was at Qantas on the 747 for 40 years. So,
oh, really?
Yeah, flying was in the blood for me, but yeah, kind of got into seaplanes because of my old man's business. And that kind of really got me in, you know, the passion started to fly floats. And then mm-hmm. you know, after that kind of very lucky start that I had with him, got a few hours up and then kind of chased the dream at Airwit Sunday and now here. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
Did you start pretty young?
Yeah, straight away. I left school or finished school and was 18 years old when I started my flight training. You know, got my commercial by 19 and was mm-hmm. float rated on my 20th birthday. And started flying floats at straight away, basically, at just after Christmas when I was 20 years old and stuck straight into it, yeah.
Yeah, oh, that's good. Good. That's
good fun. It's a good career, and I definitely recommend to anyone out there who's thinking of it to, you know, to get that float rating done and try and chase a career flying floats.
I tell everyone I would do my career over again in a minute if I could. I loved it, and, you know, I was lucky enough that I think there was 98% of the time I couldn't wait to go to work.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's a great career.
Absolutely.
Especially the Mallard flying. The seaplane, you know, by the time I got to the Mallard, I was getting a little bit disgruntled with it, but large part because the economy was changing and what they were doing with the seaplanes was changing. And the Mallard, to me at the time, was a huge step up in the right direction. Turbine IFR, which is what I wanted to do, and I was quite disappointed when we had to get rid of the Mallards.
Yeah, I imagine.
But I mean, the rest turned out, the rest of my career turned out fine, but I did love the Mallard.
Yeah, right. So you finished as a turboprop or jet pilot?
Jet. I was flying a... I flew a British Aerospace 146 for 17 years. You know what that one is?
Yeah, yep. Four-engine jet.
Yeah. Well, before that, it was a Dash 7, Dash 8 for a few years, and then 17 years on the 146, and then the last 5 years on a CRJ 705. That was a 90-seat RJ.
Okay, yep.
Yeah. All over North America.
Yep. So, how did you enjoy that part of your career?
I enjoyed it, especially the, we had such a large area to fly in. It's such a, you know, we'd do Vancouver, Los Angeles, Vancouver, and then Whitehorse in the Yukon for the night. So we saw a lot of North America, and quite a change from a busy metropolis like Los Angeles to a single runway operation in an isolated place like Whitehorse in the Yukon.
Exactly, yeah.
It was good flying.
Absolutely, mate. Now, before we wrap up the chat here, I normally finish this with a little bit of a splash and dash questionnaire. So basically like a land plane touch and go, you know, the seaplane splash and dash. We'll just touch on a few questions.
Okay, sure.
Mate, start off with, you've flown so many seaplanes by the sound of it. What would be your favorite seaplane that you've flown? I think I know the answer to this one, but...
My favorite is a Mallard, without a doubt, the Turbo Mallard.
Absolutely. What about if for anything? What comes second? I think that's probably the better question, because we know with number one so far out in front. What would be second?
My second would be the Beaver.
Yeah, nice. Any seaplanes that you spoke about before? I guess the CL-415. Would that be a dream seaplane to fly that you maybe didn't fly, or is there any other that stand out that you would love to get your hands on, or you would have loved to get your hands on in your career?
You know, no, not really. I didn't have any great desire, because airplanes that really grabbed me was a Mallard, of course, and the Beaver. I always wanted to fly those airplanes. So in my seaplane experience, I felt that I really flew the seaplanes of my dreams. And those were the two. And there were some other ones that were really interesting. The F-11 Husky, Fairchild Husky, was certainly an interesting airplane. Glad I flew it. You might find it interesting to do a little research on it, just because if you like seaplanes. It was an old airplane with fabric wings, but It was an interesting airplane. Certainly not the airplane of my dreams, but it was interesting.
Yeah, nice. Now, mate, you've landed probably in all three, so you've got open ocean, you've got a river or a lake. What would you prefer to fly and land a seaplane on if you could choose one of those? What's your favorite seaplane landing area?
Oh, I would, without a doubt, have to say the fjords. We call them inlets, but they're fjords, really. Because of the water, the colors, the vastness, the beauty of just the sheer beauty of them, and using a flying boat in those areas was wonderful. And there is one other airplane, actually, that would have been fun to fly, would be the Albatross.
Absolutely, yeah. They're...
And I don't believe there's too many of them that were ever converted to civilian. But I know that the Canadian military used to operate them into the Gulf of Alaska when they had weather ships out there. It was too far for helicopters for medevacs because they'd be 500 miles offshore in those days. And so they would use the Albatross, go out and land 500 miles offshore in the Albatross, and then they'd use JATO to get out of the water.
Yeah, right.
So I talked to a few of the guys that had flown the Albatross out there, and they said it was really challenging, the takeoff, because as you know, the Mallard Albatross, they take quite a bit of water to get off, but with the JATO packs on the tail, they would be off airborne in seconds.
Yeah, so JATO being jet-assisted takeoff for those who...
That's correct.
Yeah,
yes.
That would have been very interesting flying.
Yeah, I would have loved to have had the opportunity to do that.
Yeah, I've seen a few videos of like the Hercules and stuff like that on some gravel strips that, you know, do the JATO takeoffs just to get out of maybe a military zone or something very quickly and climb up very fast. On a seaplane, that would be pretty epic. mate, finally, I'm sure you've met a lot of young and aspiring seaplane pilots out there. What advice would you give to anyone who wants to be a seaplane pilot?
Well, I think that one of the... anybody who wants to be a seaplane pilot is really keep your eyes and ears open all the time. Listen to the old guys because they've got a lot of wealth of knowledge and experience. And be sure you listen. And you don't have to follow everything they say, but you pick up the good parts and listen. And there's nothing wrong with making a mistake as long as you learn from it and don't keep repeating them. And that's about it. Other than that, I'd say go and have some fun because it's wonderful.
Awesome. Well, Kurt Miller, it's been awesome having a chat to you, mate, all about your seaplane career. And I'd really like to say thanks for taking the time to join me on the step here and talking all things float planes.
Well, you're very welcome, Daniel. It's been a real pleasure talking to you. And anytime I get a chance to talk seaplanes, especially Mallard seaplanes. You've made my day. Thanks, Daniel.
Perfect. No worries, mate. Great to have you on the line here. All the best.
Okay, we'll keep in touch, eh?
Sounds good. Cheers, mate.
Okay, bye-bye.
And that's the show for today, folks. Thanks, Kurt, for joining the show and sharing your stories. And don't forget to leave a review, folks, if you love the podcast, and get in touch to be featured on the Seaplane Spotlight Seaplane School, or even just to say hello. Like I said, I try and reply to everyone who gets in contact with me, so get in touch there. Now, before we go, here is a little taste of next episode number 14.
Landing on the equator was pretty exciting. I've been sailing since I was a kid, and I was really keen to not just fly over the equator but also cross it as a boat. So after I'd cross the equator, I did a U-turn, did a downwind leg, came back and landed just south of the equator, taxied across, and then took off again. So that was in the middle of the ocean, which I, you know, in hindsight was pretty silly, but at the time it seemed like a really cool idea.
That voice is Michael Smith, the 2016 Australian Geographic Adventurer of the Year winner, after becoming the first person to solo circumnavigate the world in a single engine flying boat. Here's some very cool stories for you all, but until next time, everyone, thanks for coming on The Step.